Great Leon Thomas with It's My Life I'm Fighting For, featuring his distinctive guttural yodeling. This is from The Creator, a compilation album of his selected songs from 1969 to 1973 and released in 2013. This is Lead Stories. I'm Yatrice Lead. Lots of things happening in the world today, but they'll still be there tomorrow, and we'll tackle them then. But today, you're in for a great treat, and you're always in for a treat when our guest appears on this program. He is one of the most popular guests appearing on Lead Stories, Dr. Gerald Horn. Noted historian, scholar, and prolific author, Dr. Gerald Horn holds the John Jay and Rebecca Morris Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. He has written dozens, that's right, I said dozens of books, and hundreds of articles, commentaries, and scholarly papers on global struggles against imperialism, colonialism, fascism, and racism. He's with us today to discuss his latest book, The Dawning of the Apocalypse, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, Settler Colonialism, and Capitalism in the Long 16th Century. Wow, what a title. Welcome, Gerald. Good to have you once more with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, my first question comes from the very title of your book. Why did you call it the Long 16th Century?
Well, I'm dealing with the period roughly stretching from 1492, when Columbus sailed the ocean blue, up until 1607, when the English invaded the eastern seaboard of North America, the territory that they referred to as Virginia after the so-called Virgin Queen, Queen Elizabeth. And fundamentally, I'm trying to answer this question, and historians should know, although sometimes they forget, that if you don't pose the appropriate question, you can easily wind up with answers that are similarly inappropriate. And the question is, how did this minor kingdom on the fringes of Europe, which was basically not a major power at the time of Columbus making his voyage, how were they able to come from behind and then surge ahead by the time my story ends? How was it, how is it that people of African descent, such as myself, wind up in North America speaking the tongue of this minor kingdom on the outskirts of Europe? And so part of the story is embedded in religion. That is to say that you recall that Spain was a predominantly Catholic nation, although it had been ruled by Muslims up until about 1492. And then in 1517, you had the so-called Protestant Reformation led by Martin Luther. Protestantism spreads quickly to England in the 1530s, which sets up a battle between Protestant England and Catholic Spain. Now, Spain takes religion a bit too seriously, I might say. You have to qualify as a Catholic in order to be a settler, which basically meant that even if you were African, you could be a conquistador if you profess Catholicism. This was the case, for example, in Cuba, which was settled by the Spanish in the early 1500s. And it was also, to a certain extent, the case in what amounts to the origins of settler colonialism in North America, speaking of St. Augustine, Florida, in 1565. The scrappy underdogs that were the Protestants were not able to have Protestantism as a qualifier to be a settler, not least because there were not enough Protestants to go around at that moment. It's a relatively new religious sect in the 1500s, whereas Catholicism, as you know, had existed about 1500 years, more or less, and therefore had a numerical and chronological advantage. And so as a matter of improvisation, the English moved towards pan-Europeanism, which morphs into whiteness and then morphs into white supremacy. That is to say, those who they had been in conflict with were welcomed into the settler colonial embrace. That includes Irish Catholics. You know that England and Ireland had been in conflict for centuries, and the conflict was turbocharged once London moved towards Protestantism, and a good deal of the Irish did not, setting up this ostensible Protestant-Irish conflict. And even the Jewish population of England, which was expelled in 1291, 200 years roughly before they were expelled from Spain in 1492, England opens its embrace to this population as well. And this turns out, in the long run, to be the winning ticket. That is to say, religious sectarianism tends to fall by the wayside as this more ecumenical approach, or more racist approach, depending on how you look at it, of London surges ahead. And then I should also say that London also cuts a deal with the Muslim powers. That probably, as much as anything else, helps to explain why we're speaking English. The other power in Europe, if not the world, were the Ottoman Turks. The Ottoman Turks had ousted the Christians from what is now Istanbul in 1453, which really frightened the Western European Christendom. And the Ottoman Turks steadily moved west. They were equal opportunity enslavers, not only enslaving Africans, but as the history of Albania and Bosnia and Kosovo and North, what is now called North Macedonia, tend to suggest, not to mention Bulgaria, they enslaved Europeans as well. So what happens is that when London begins to oust the Catholics, when it turns towards Protestantism, it actually liquidates Catholic property. And other than pocketing it itself, that is to say in the pockets of the king, King Henry VIII, they were shipping a lot of the proceeds to the Ottomans, who could then wage war against their mutual antagonist, which is Spain. A turning point in terms of the precipitous decline of Africa comes in 1591, when England, in league with the Muslim power of that time, which was Morocco and North Africa, jointly waged war against the Songhai Empire, which, by the way, was Muslim too, but, you know, we're entering a new stage where religious affiliation basically yields to the lust for profit. And what happens is that the Songhai Empire is destabilized, which has negative knock-on effects throughout Africa, as far south as today's Nigeria, softening up West Africa for the onrushing African slave trade, which London becomes a leader of, at least until the Yankees take over post-1776. And that helps to explain why so many Africans are now in North America speaking this language, speaking the tongue of this minor kingdom on the fringes of Europe.
Well, it is indeed a long 16th century. What would you say was the most pivotal point, the point that really drove this quest for conquest over the edge?
Well, there are many turning points. I pointed to a number in my previous comment, 1517, the Protestant Reformation. Ironically enough, a disproportionate percentage of the Africans in this hemisphere, or at least in North America, are either Protestant or Muslim, which is ironic given the fact that the Protestants and the Muslims, their collaboration, were pivotal in terms of the onrushing African slave trade. And then the 1530s, when London turns towards Protestantism, I would also say 1572, when there's murderous Rwanda-type genocidal conflict between Protestants and Catholics in France, the St. Bartholomew's Massacre, where the Catholics who wind up prevailing in France invite Protestants to meetings and then fall upon them and massacre thousands, a tactic that was then deployed against the indigenous population of the Americas. In fact, part of what I say in this book is that a lot of the strategies and tactics that were deployed against Africans and indigenous in either Africa or North America are in many ways honed by Europeans against each other in the 1500s, such as the St. Bartholomew's Massacre. And then 1565, the origins of St. Augustine, Florida, 1591, of course. And a instrumental part of my story also is the construction of whiteness. That is to say, how was it that those who had been warring on the shores of Europe, not only what I've just made reference to, English versus Irish and Christian versus Jewish, but also British versus German, German versus Pole, Pole versus Russian, Russian versus Hungarian, Hungarian versus Serbian, Serbian versus Kosovar, I mean, the list is endless. How all of a sudden, in a rebranding that would make Madison Avenue blush, how somehow were they reconstituted as, quote, white once they traversed the Atlantic? And, of course, this has a lot to do with what we in the trade union movement used to call pork chop unity. That is to say, folks who might have had conflicts decide to unite so they could share the pork chops. The pork chops, in this case, being the free labor of Africans and the land of the dispossessed indigenous populations. And this, of course, involved a retreat of the religious sectarianism, which then, to fast forward, is embodied in the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which calls for religious liberty, as you know. And many historians have portrayed this as an exemplar of what they would call Enlightenment philosophy, where these Europeans say, you know what, religious sectarianism is backwards. We need to move away from that. When actually it's just a sort of pork chop unity. I mean, you're basically saying we want as many warm European bodies as possible, be they Christian or Catholic or Protestant or Jewish or whatever. And so therefore we're going to sweep aside, at least for the time being, this religious conflict. And of course, we know that that doesn't work altogether. They're burning down a convent in the United States in the 1830s. You may be familiar with the Leo Frank case, this Jewish guy who was lynched in Georgia as World War I is being launched about 100 years ago. And I would also say that the Supreme Court of the United States in its recent decisions is giving signs that the religious sectarianism might be on its way back, that this religious liberty idea might have outlived its usefulness. And if you think about it, you can see this as a partial result of the fact that race, this other important rubric, had been forced to retreat because of the Haitian Revolution, 1791 to 1804, because of the attack on Jim Crow in the 1950s, which was largely driven by external factors, such as the rise of a socialist camp appealing to resource-rich Africa, and Washington found it difficult to execute U.S. foreign policy when African-Americans were treated so atrociously and horribly. And so now with this changed dispensation and the fact that, to a certain extent, that involved the devaluation of the currency that was whiteness, you have this now recrudescence of the religious factor, which is something I'm afraid to say, unless folks wake up, we're going to have to deal with sooner rather than later.
Well, I hope people listening so far appreciate the complexity of what we think is a straightforward argument, a straightforward thing, you know, whiteness, white supremacy. We're just starting to get into it, and already you can see the twists and turns that were taken, and all in the interest of somebody, some group, emerging as victorious. And then comes the second part. Okay, they've won, but who are these people? They're not exactly uniform in religion or in theory, political theory or anything. So they're starting now to unify themselves along some other line. And it turns out that the whiteness was a perfectly acceptable place to start, because you had, as they call it, you had volume going in the favor of the people who wanted to figure out what the next move would be. In the United States, in the meantime, now, so we outside of Europe, and we're now getting closer and closer to the U.S. proper. Was there any tumult? Was there any fragmentation? Or were the lines still whole? Were people still in general agreement that they were in charge?
Who is the they you're referring to?
I mean the British in particular.
Oh, sure. I mean, early on, of course, there is a sort of pecking order amongst the European migrants. Certainly, there's a replica of the English on top. And of course, interestingly enough, if you look at the U.S. president, you'll find disproportionately and overwhelmingly they have roots in the British Isles, many of them being Northern Ireland Protestant roots, such as Ronald Wilson Reagan, for example. And that brings me to another point, which is that even though this story ostensibly deals with the long 16th century, 1492 to 1607, as already indicated, I also go back to 1453, I go back to 1291, the expulsion of the Jewish population from England, I go back to 1095, when you have the onset of the Crusades. That is to say, when Western European Christendom decides that the time has come to reclaim the territory they call the Holy Land from the Muslims. And these crusades, so-called, extend for hundreds of years. And it's important to my story because, to some extent, this question of race, which is a relatively new concept, in some ways extends from this conflict over religiosity and continues to be inflected, if not turbocharged, by religiosity, as I've already made reference to, with regard to the 1500s conflicts between Protestants and Catholics, for example. And perhaps unsurprisingly, when there is an effort to ignite a process of enslaving of Africans, which, by the way, extends before 1492, as I show in the book, oftentimes the Africans who are selected for enslavement come from areas of Africa that are predominantly Islamic, such as today's Senegal, for example. So I've been involved in this quest to try to locate the roots of whiteness and white supremacy. I thought in my 17th century book, I had found it in the 17th century, but actually I was really just describing just the new stage in its evolution. In this book, I'm going back to 1095, and now I'm sufficiently humble, some might say humiliated, to recognize that perhaps I should even go back before 1095, which if this pandemic ever ends and I'm still walking on planet Earth, I'll probably do.
Of what value, of what intrinsic value was being white?
In North America or in the Americas generally?
In the Americas and in the formation or the evolution of this power that would, you know, you'd find it one group dominating and the group would be white. Of what intrinsic value were you able to locate an explanation for why white?
Well, I think it dulled class antagonism. Interestingly enough, in 2020, you have many so-called left-wing commentators who will go unmentioned who are trying to explain this Trump phenomenon through various means. And interestingly enough, I'm going to give a virtual talk about this on Monday. There is a kind of a split that's developing in terms of providing an answer to that question, even in elite circles. For example, as I tell the story, what sheds light on the Trump phenomenon is the fact that this construction of whiteness helps to dull class consciousness and helps to dull class antagonism, which helps to explain why 63 million people in November 2016, many of whom would be defined as, quote, white, unquote, vote for a faux billionaire rather than join hands with their fellow workers, who may not be defined as white, in a sort of class-based alliance. And that's been fundamentally the history of settler colonialism, which is a term that sadly is just becoming popularized to describe North America, although it's obviously been a settler colonial project since 1607, if not before, in St. Augustine, Florida in 1565. And this dulling of class antagonisms is something I also talk about in my 17th century book. That's me. Hello?
Yes, I'm listening.
Oh, okay.
How does capitalism become a factor?
Well, the slave trade is one of the most profitable enterprises known to humankind. You can invest $1 and get $1,700 back, and there are those who would sell their firstborn for 1,700% profit. In order to transport Africans across the Atlantic, not to mention European settlers across the Atlantic, that presupposes the existence of ships, which presupposes a shipping industry and the construction of ships, which presupposes a working class that gets wages that then can use those wages to buy other goods and products. And from London's point of view, creating a virtuous circle. Also, in order to have enslaved trade, you needed an insurance industry, because there was a tendency of Africans to rebel either on shore or on the vessel itself, which would induce losses for investors. They buy insurance, but as I'm sure you know from the insurance industry, the key to their profits is they take your premiums, but then don't pay out when the time comes to pay out after an accident or a fire or a pandemic or whatever, as they point to the fine print in the contract. And so then this leads to a surplus of capital, so to speak, which then can be parlayed into banks, which then can use that capital either to finance more slave voyages or finance other enterprises, for example, the building of houses, for example. And therein you begin to see the roots of capitalism. But let me return to Bacon's Rebellion, because in 1676 you have this gentleman by the name of Nathaniel Bacon, who is a man of means, joined by men not of means, in a revolt against London, because they thought London and Virginia was not moving with sufficient aggressiveness or audacity to take the land from the Native Americans and turn it over to Bacon and his comrades. This was happening at the time when London was faced with a triple-layered revolt. There was a revolt of the enslaved in Barbados, for example, which almost toppled the settler rule in 1676. There was a revolt in what they call New England in 1676 of the indigenous population. And so London's options were limited. And so fundamentally what they did was to buy off, to a certain extent, Bacon and his comrades, which then leads to this repetitive pattern whereby European settlers could be bought off by Native American land, and with a little pluck and a lot of luck, they could parlay that into finding or ensnaring, I should say, enslaved Africans to work that land for free. And even when you had Native Americans, like the Cherokee, for example, who approximately 200 years ago began to try to assimilate, and that's why they were called civilized. They were civilized because not only did they profess Christianity, but they enslaved Africans as well. But that was not sufficient, and they were forced by Mr. Trump's favorite president, Andrew Jackson, to be ethnically cleansed in the Trail of Tears, forced into Oklahoma, which was supposed to be their Indian territory. And there's a footnote to this story, because many of the Cherokees sided with the Confederacy during the U.S. Civil War. In fact, the last Confederate general to surrender in June 1865 was a Cherokee general, Stan Watty. And interestingly enough, the Cherokee slave owners were some of the few slave owners who were forced to disgorge the equivalent of 40 acres and a mule, which then helps to enrich a number of formerly enslaved Africans. But then, as you know, in 1921, with the Tulsa Massacre, recall that the Oath in the Oval Office was speaking in Tulsa approximately the day after the anniversary of the Tulsa Massacre in June 1921. The Euro-American settlers then massacre Black Wall Street and the Negroes in Tulsa, take their land, and they wind up as poor as the rest of us.
I hope people are listening to this and beginning to say to themselves, how come all of this is not already known? How is it that we are not at all in tune with this part of our history and the evolution of not just our history, but about concepts of power, and the concepts of power rooted in religion, rooted in skin color, whiteness? What is to be understood today of what currency, what kind of currency does whiteness have today? Is it the same or is it different?
I think it's different. Otherwise, we probably wouldn't be talking about this to an audience. And I think that another way to interpret the November 2016 election is a revolt against what could be called the devaluation of the currency that was whiteness, that had been ignited by the anti-Jim Crow movement, the civil rights movement, decades earlier. Of course, this was not the first revolt. There was a revolt in 1957, which I'm sure many of your listeners know about, in Little Rock, Arkansas, against school desegregation. There was revolt in 1962 in Oxford, Mississippi, when James Meredith was trying to integrate the University of Mississippi, a revolt in the 1970s in Boston, where there was an attempt to desegregate the schools in Boston. And, of course, there are many, many more. But November 2016, well, let's hope that it represents the zenith of these kinds of revolts, because the United States is going through an interesting moment right now. I'm giving this talk on Monday, and so I've been trying to gather my thoughts. And you have these various splits. You have splits, of course, amongst conservatives, that is to say the never-Trumpers and the pro-Trumpers. You have splits on the left, not only with regard to, say, Congressman Elliot Engel of the Bronx losing his seat to Jamal Bowman, or Congressman Lacey Clay of the Black Caucus losing his seat yesterday to Black woman competitor Cori Bush, but you also have these ideological conflicts as well. I see this in the 1619 Project of the New York Times, which the author, the spearhead of that project, suggested that slavery was a motive force of the revolt against British rule that led to the United States of America, which then engendered a vitriolic, even obscene response. Since this is a family program, I can't repeat some of the insults that was tossed at Nicole Hannah Jones as a result of her audacity to suggest that the Immaculate Conception notion of the founding United States had flaws, that this was basically a creation myth. And at the same time, you had Harvard African American Studies sponsor another Ivy League scholar who suggested that, contrary to common sense, the U.S. Constitution was actually an anti-slavery document, which will come as a surprise to those who were adjudged to be three-fifths of a human being per that document, come as a surprise to those who look at the fugitive slave clause of that document, which forced those who did not own enslaved Africans to return them to their owners. And even come as a surprise to those who are trying to defeat Mr. Trump, because this slave-projected electoral college, which allowed Mr. Trump to lose the popular vote by 3 million votes and still be declared the winner, this time it might allow him to lose the popular vote by 6 million votes and be declared the winner because of this slave-inflected electoral college. So you have all of these splits taking place, and I think that that's a good sign, that's a hopeful sign, because I think what's happening is that something new is struggling to be born, and as ever, the old is not giving up willingly or voluntarily. And as we speak today, it's unclear which side will prevail, I'm afraid to say.
Well, if you have questions brewing in your brain, this would be a time to gather your thoughts. We'll take questions very shortly of Dr. Gerald Horn, author of this newly released book, The Dawning of the Apocalypse, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, Settler Colonialism, and Capitalism in the Long 16th Century. 888-874-4888 is the number to call. You mentioned that there might be an evolution yet being undertaken. We don't know what it is about, do we? Or do we have a clue what it is about and what the results are? Or are they the same results as they were before, to dominate and to emerge as the ruling class?
Well, at this point, it's unclear, but I do think, it's unclear what will happen. I do think that there is a conflict taking place. You see it globally, too. In John Bolton, the Fox national security advisor of Mr. Trump, who's just written this tell-all memoir, The Room Where It Happened, he suggests that second to China, Mr. Trump's antipathy and animosity was directed towards the European Union, and particularly Germany, which obviously is problematic as the United States tries to develop this broad alliance against the People's Republic of China, which, of course, the United States had been in de facto alliance with since the early 1970s. So these fractures that I'm talking about are global, they're domestic, and to a certain extent, they have become inevitable. I think turbocharged by the pandemic. And also, I think that historians might well conclude that domestically, we reached a new stage on May 25th, 2020, when George Floyd was executed on camera by an officer of the state, which not only helped to engender mass protests that are still going on, leading to not only change, but conflict. We can talk about either or both if you're interested, but also helped to engender a remarkable initiative at the Human Rights Council of the United Nations, where the African Union, headquartered in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, filed a motion calling for a commission of inquiry into what they call systemic racism in the United States of America. Now, because of intense lobbying and arm twisting by Washington, this resolution did not take flight, and it didn't take flight as well, because I'm not even sure if the strugglers on this side of the Atlantic were even aware of what was being done on our behalf. But in any case, I doubt if that's the end of those kinds of initiatives. In some ways, we're back to the old Cold War, when you had this conflict between Washington and Moscow, and Washington felt it had to make overtures in order to deflect the challenge from Moscow. Now you may see Mr. Trump speaking less about S-hole nations, which includes the entire African continent, because the U.S. ruling elite is trying to develop this multifaceted alliance against the People's Republic of China, and they need all hands on deck. And you might even see a less invective directed towards Chancellor Merkel of Germany and the European Union as a result. But we'll see, since Mr. Trump is notoriously lacking discipline and is notoriously improvisational and can't necessarily stick to the script. But in any case, you may be correct in the implication of your question that all of this ultimately may be sound and fury signifying no change. Or on the other hand, it could be something different.
Bay from New York, you're on the air with Professor Gerald Horn.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Good, good, good. And I want to thank you for playing the jazz. And number two, Shashi McIntyre was one of my educators when I was going to school, when you mentioned her, and I meant to mention that too. Listen to the conversation. I thought it was very good. Number one, I guess it's not a question as much of a comment. We're Moorish Americans, descendants of Moroccans, and born in the United States. So when you mentioned about the slavery during that time, 1774, and actually prior to that with Christopher Columbus and that whole the whole thing coming over here to the United States. So in your research, have you done anything as far as showing that there were already people already over here, and that those slave names of Negro, Black, and Colored that they were given by prior to 1774? That's just a question.
Well,
thank you.
You're probably familiar with the book by the late Ivan Van Sertima, They Came Before Columbus, which posits that there are these escalator-type ocean currents that pull people across the Atlantic. You've had similar, the caller might be familiar with Thor Heyerdahl, who tried to suggest a similar escalating currents taking people from the South Seas to the western coast of South America. I did a book some years ago, The White Pacific, which caused me to go to Fiji, a neighbor of New Zealand and Australia, where the people look like yourself and myself, and they speak a language that has many loan words from languages in East Africa, which is linguistic evidence that people were sailing from East Africa across the Indian Ocean and the Pacific Ocean to Fiji. So I think it's highly possible that there were Africans in North America pre-1565. I mean, certainly the Spanish post-1492 were dragging Africans into this hemisphere. And I talk about how, if you're in New York, you may be familiar with Verrazano Narrows Bridge. And Verrazano, when he sails to that part of North America, he says that he sees dark-skinned people. This is in the 1520s, before European settlement in what is now New York. So it's possible, but, I would not want to use that argument, however, to act like, you know, Native Americans don't exist. We liquidate that entire ethnic group, that entire national grouping, and say they're all black people, which sometimes is where that argument leads, and it's an argument that I resist because I think they deserve respect.
Well, thanks, Bay, for your question. Henry from Chicago, you're on the air.
Hey, Trees, how's it going?
All right, thanks.
All right, Dr. Horn, as one of your unofficial students, you recently released book the Dawning of the Apocalypse, and then the book you wrote published two years ago, Colonial, I forget the name of the title, but which book I'm behind in reading your books. Which book should I read first? Should I read the recent book and then the book you wrote before, or should I go in the order that it was published?
Well, if I may, I would suggest read in chronological order. As a matter of fact, sometimes I wish I had written these in chronological order, because I think if I had written this 16th century book before I wrote the 17th century book, and these books on the 18th and 19th century, I think that those subsequent books would have been better for it. But alas, somehow I got into this process of working backwards. And as I said, assuming this pandemic eases up, the next book might deal, say, with the conflict between the Nubians and the Romans, and, you know, going back hundreds of years, going back millennia. And perhaps I should have started at that point. But, you know, you do what you can with what you got.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thanks, Henry, for your question. Bruce from New York, you're on the air with Professor Horn.
Yeah. Hello, Utrecht. Professor Horn.
Hi.
Some time ago, I heard you say that that the history of the United States, or that historians have to look at rewriting the history of the United States, because based on how they describe history, how we describe history, this exceptionalism that is in the, you know, that is current, that should not produce a Donald Trump. Yeah, and now that you've had more time to think about that, I wonder if you still feel this way, and if you do, how have you been able to develop this idea in your own mind?
Utrecht, I think you're going to have to repeat the question, because I'm not sure if I understood it.
Go ahead, Bruce. Repeat your question.
Yeah, okay. Professor Horn, I was some time ago, you said that that Donald Trump is not consistent with the theory of exceptionalism espoused by Americans generally. And now that you've had some time to think about this idea, you know, I wonder if you still feel this way. And if you feel this way, how have you been able to develop this idea that about the rewriting of the whole architecture of history in this country, major narratives, in your own mind? How have you been able to think further about this?
Well, if I understand the question, this idea of so-called American exceptionalism is really sort of an idea of chauvinism. That is to say, never before or since have you had a country like the United States with these founding fathers who walked on water, the greatest of great generations of all time, and supposedly constructed this sturdy democracy. One of the points I'm going to mention in this talk that I keep referring to on Monday is that students must be confused, because they'll go to their history class and they'll learn about what I just articulated, so-called American exceptionalism, and how this sturdy democracy was constructed. And then they may go to their political science class, where the professor will be wringing her hands about the prospect of a looming U.S. fascism, which is contrary to this idea that this sturdy democracy was constructed in the late 18th century. And of course, the answer is that there was no sturdy democracy that was constructed in the late 18th century. I think that what you had constructed in North America was in many ways an apartheid state, because the Bill of Rights, the vaunted Bill of Rights, did not apply to my ancestors. There was no Second Amendment right to bear arms by enslaved Africans. If there had been, believe me, as the Oval Office likes to say. Believe me, slavery would have ended well before 1865 if the Africans had the right to bear arms per the Bill of Rights in the late 18th century. And so many things are sort of coming to a head right now. I'm afraid to say that many of our historians are not up to the task that has been allotted to them. Many of them are these intellectual silos where they write book after book on the manufacturing of shoestrings in late 18th century France, for example. Many of them accept the make-believe of history. I just put forward this idea that the retreat from religious sectarianism was driven by facts on the ground, the need to round up warm European bodies to confront revolting Africans and rebellious indigenous populations. Of course, they take the point of view, these believers and make-believe, speaking of these historians, that it was all because these European men came to an enlightenment in their heads, that the better part of wisdom was to retreat from religious sectarianism. So if I understand the question, my response is that I think that this notion of so-called American exceptionalism should be buried in rubble. It's dysfunctional. It's basically a fairy tale, basically designed to throw dust in the eyes of the public.
Thank you, Bruce, for your question. Ed from Jamaica, you're on with Dr. Gerald Horn.
Good afternoon, Beatrice. How are you?
Fine, thank you. Hope you are, too.
We're well. ISA didn't do too much damage. Good afternoon, Dr. Horn. I'm an avid fan of your work, and I've got several of your books. Hopefully I'll pick up this new one once the pandemic calms down. My question is pertaining to reparations. As far as the history of slavery and its bulwark in the creation of the American experience, such as it is, what is your view on the legitimacy of the claim of American descendants of slaves, or better yet, ADOS, and the ability of this country to ever see a clear path for reparative justice? I'll take the answer off the air.
Well, I won't enter the thicket of ADOS, the American descendants of slaves, but on the essence of your question, obviously I'm in favor of reparations. And in fact, I would recommend the book by my former Chapel Hill colleague, William Darity, From Here to Equality, which is probably the most developed book on reparations, standing alongside that of Sir Hilary Beckles of Barbados. Interestingly enough, there has been a reparation claim coming out of Africa, believe it or not. A document was just signed which mandates that this African government go into international capital markets and raise $3 billion. However, it's not for those who suffered colonialism or minority regimes. It's the government of Zimbabwe, because of pressure, forced to raise $3 billion to turn it over to these European farmers who had the backing of the government in Washington and North Atlantic generally. And it's a really a twist, to put it mildly, on this claim of reparations.
Well, we're getting close to the end of the program, Gerald. I wanted to know that you could make a comeback soon to this program, perhaps as soon as your schedule allows, because we have quite a few more people wanting to talk to you and ask you questions.
Oh, sure. It's my pleasure, to use my Rhodesian accent.
Your pleasure. Okay. So I will certainly, good luck with your lecture coming up. But please, let's make time for your return to continue this discussion. How would you say, as we wrap up, this book, where does it fit in your scheme of things, of writing history? Where do you plug it in? In what sequence does it appear?
Well, I mean, I'm partial to this book that just came out, and I've been talking about it a lot which then sharpens my brain to talk about it even more. So that leads me to be biased in favor of. And then, of course, in terms of everything that I've written, it's the first chronologically. And then, as I said, it goes back to 1095. And so assuming, once again, that we can survive this pandemic and survive climate change and nuclear war, hopefully I'll go back further, and then that'll become my favorite book.
How do you regard this book? It's hard to ask an author about his own writing, but how do you regard it? Is it something that has emerged in your own heart as essential?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Because, you know, I live in North America. I was born in North America. And so it's dear to my heart to explain how this project of settler colonialism evolved. And if I might say so, I'm not sure if the U.S. left, to put it mildly, to put it euphemistically, has done. I don't think the U.S. has done a very good job of explaining history. I think the U.S. left, it's like when talking about religion. I think oftentimes they're too driven by contemporary issues. That is to say, the desire to have a reconciliation between Protestants and Christians and Jewish populations, and then they try to read that back to find a sort of conciliation at the time they were at sword's point. And I think that the better way to proceed is to talk about what really happened so we can know what happened, and then that helps to determine why there might be lingering antagonisms today. And likewise, I think that there's been this felt desire, which I understand, to build interracial, multiracial unity, and then you try to read that back to the 1500s and 1600s, and it really doesn't fit very well. And then that leads many black people to think that the U.S. left is basically involved in a cover-up. They really don't understand white supremacy, which probably is not an unfair assertion. And so I think that I'm not only trying to present a new kind of left and radical history, I'm trying to also help black people in particular understand how we wound up in this pickle we're now in.
Uh-huh. Well, I want to thank you, as always, for taking your time to be with us today. I congratulate you on the publication of The Dawning of the Apocalypse, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, Settler Colonialism, and Capitalism in the Long 16th Century. Thanks again, and hopefully you'll hear from me very soon, and we'll set a date for your next appearance.
Thank you for inviting me.
Not at all. Delighted to do that. Okay, folks, many of you didn't get a chance to ask a question. You will certainly have the opportunity to do so very soon. We'll call back Gerald Horn and find out when he can avail himself to us next. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye.
You led me on a dream with no reality, to try and take my pride, take my legacy. Your naked world has no respectability.